All right. Hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Welcome back.
I'm Jane.
I'm Allison.
And this is the Flick Chicks podcast.
It's true. Jane, how are you?
I'm all right. Just still working on my thesis. It's due tomorrow. So just finishing up on editing. I'm going to a friend's recital tonight. I'm very excited because he's very talented. And I'm just really excited to watch him do his thing.
Heck yes. Heck yes.
And yeah, I'm very excited. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I leave for London tomorrow. So, I know. Well, by the time this comes out, I'll be coming back. But I have to leave super early, so I'm worried because I feel like I'm not going to be able to fall asleep because I'm trying to go to bed so early. So hopefully I can fall asleep because I have to be up so early. But it's okay. I'm really excited to get to see my friend Jared.
Yes, I'm so excited. I'm so jealous that I can't be there.
I know.
With two of my best friends.
I know. It's going to be so fun. I'm so excited. I got tickets to see the Book of Mormon, finally.
Oh my gosh, finally. I'm so excited to finally be able to talk about it with you.
I'm finally going to have seen it. I've been trying to see it for so long, so I'm so excited. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. Well, this week, we're tackling a big one.
It's a white whale, if you would like to say.
Sure. It's a white, if you would like to say. No, you know what? I wouldn't like to say it. We're going to do Martin Scorsese's Someone Argue Masterpiece,
Taxi Driver. Some argue. 1976.
Indeed.
Taxi Driver.
It's pretty good. It's referenced. It's a highly influential film.
It is. It is in both, like, culture and film, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And a lot of films, like, it pulled from a lot of influential films. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Martin Scorsese.
Watching, when we watched Joker, I was like, wow, this is like, there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, there's a ton of Taxi Driver references in Joker. Tons. Plus, I'm sure you haven't seen this film because I've only seen it because I'm in a film major now. But I'm not a film major, guys, don't come at me, but
you're basically a film major.
But at least for this semester, I'm a film major. And so I've been watching a lot of French New Wave films. And we love the New Wave. That's all we've been talking about. but it pulls a lot from the French New Wave, especially with, like, the colors, and there's this film called Breathless that it really pulls from. Listen, it's not so bad. Sometimes I'm like, ugh, cinema. But then you really watch it, and you're like, yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, damn it, they really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's when I forget movies are my favorite movie, and then I rewatch them, and I'm like, oh.
Oh, I know.
It's amazing.
There's so many films. There's just so many movies. And I love so many, and they're all so different. Like, I love the SpongeBob movie, but I also love this movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah.
I love both of them. Really. It's like, is the SpongeBob movie that good? Yes, it is. Maybe I shouldn't use that as an example. I think it's a great movie. but it's like, there are some movies that they're not good, but your brain may say no, but your heart just says yes.
It's true. I totally understand that. I have a couple movies that are just pretty horrific that I have a really big place in my heart for them. I don't think this is a horrific movie, but I have such a large part in my heart that loves American Tail.
See, it's like, I can't say it's a bad movie. It's not a bad movie. It's a good movie. It's just different. It's a different kind of movie.
It's a different kind of movie.
I know the SpongeBob movie isn't, like, influencing any films, but
it influenced a lot of people.
It influenced me.
As a film major now.
Exactly. I'm ready to take my final project, Why the SpongeBob Movie is the Greatest Animated Film of All Time. I'm ready.
What film classes are you taking this semester?
Patreon episode. I'm taking European cinema. So that's where I've been learning about all the different new waves in Europe. And I'm taking critical approaches to Hollywood cinema.
That sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's okay. It's a good... I like the class because I like the movies we talk about in there the most because they're the movies I know the most of.
Uh-huh.
But I also hate the teachers in that class the most, so it's kind of a toss-up.
Is this the one that says a lot?
I have... So, the way teachers here work are not the way teachers in the States work. They, like, rotate out. So, I don't just have one teacher for any class, except European cinema. For some reason, she's the only person that teaches that class. But in all my other classes, I have four professors that rotate.
That is so wild.
Yeah. So, it's like, some weeks I like the professors and some weeks I don't. And all the professors here are pretty shoddy, honestly. But some of them are good. Some of them are really bad, though. You know what I mean? None of them are great. But some of them are okay. And especially when you compare them to the ones that are really not okay. and then I'm taking science fiction and film and television.
That's so fun.
That one is really fun. But I don't like anyone in my class. So
that sucks.
I don't know if I don't like them. I just don't know them or want to get to know them at all. Because they all seem not great.
You're God's lonely man.
I was born God's lonely man. I've always been this way. Oh, boy. I love this movie so much.
I love this movie. It's so... there's just so many little moments in it that you're just like...
I know.
They're stunningly good. Robert De Niro in this movie.
I know.
It's
not a movie I like to watch a lot, but every time I watch it, I'm like, wow. It really is good.
It really is that good. You know, that's...
It's a movie that requires that you pay attention.
Definitely, definitely. You really, like, you get attached to the characters, and it's a lot.
Yeah, you can't zone out during this movie. Which a lot of people have a problem with. A lot of people like to zone out in films.
And play on their phones.
I know, which is kind of like, what's the point?
I'm definitely one of those people who likes to sit down and watch a movie if I'm going to watch a movie.
I know, me too. Well, if I've seen a movie before, like, maybe I'll not watch it the most, but some films just require a watch, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This film is
like, mesmerizing. It's like a kaleidoscope.
I know, yeah. I think that's what's so good about this film is it's like, it draws you in. It's like the void.
Yeah, definitely. It's like you're staring into the void for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I don't actually know how long the movie is.
I don't know. I have no idea how long it is either. It feels long.
It feels long.
Feels long.
So this film, directed by Martin Scorsese, very early Scorsese. He's actually in the movie and he looks so young.
Yeah.
And it also stars Robert De Niro and Jodie Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Who is very good. She had to go through therapy before she could be approved to play this role.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think so too.
I was going to say, wow, but then I was like, no, I'd probably also.
They just had to make sure that she was, like, resilient enough or she wouldn't be, like, that she understood what was happening.
Yeah. Now we have, like, intimacy directors and stuff, but they really didn't have those back in the day. Still don't know how much intimacy directors are used, but I think they should be used more. Especially in films with children.
That's my new dream job.
Intimacy director?
Yeah.
Well, some people call them intimacy choreographers too, but basically, like, their job is to work around really difficult scenes involving, like, sex and touching and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, like, as to choreograph them so that they don't make anyone uncomfortable. Or, like, you've heard stories of, like, oh, this was improv, and he grabbed her and slapped her across the face, and she didn't know that was going to happen. And it's like, well, that's actually really not cool at all.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
It's more like for that.
This movie is so good, but I think there's a lot to unpack here. I know that we often have trouble talking about movies that are so, so good, but I think that there's a lot to unpack in this film.
Yeah. I think...
So, what's it about, Allison?
I think it's about isolation.
Yes.
And
I agree.
How maddening it is.
Yeah, how corrosive loneliness is.
And I also think this is one of those movies, it's just like Fight Club, where if the guy went to therapy, it wouldn't exist. You know what I mean? It's one of those movies. Because this movie is also like really about toxic masculinity. You know what I mean?
This is some real toxic masculinity.
Exactly. Real toxic masculinity. Because it's just like, okay. This is just a movie about a guy who likes a girl and she rejects him. And then he goes fucking crazy.
Yeah, and that happens all the time.
I mean,
so it's
true.
not an unrealistic story for sure.
I know.
Which is kind of like almost the most terrifying part about it.
I know. Is that it's like it could happen.
Like this could definitely happen, and you know, it incited not incited violence, but it inspired violence.
Yeah, he definitely, it's weird too, because he, like, has a hero complex, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and then it's interesting, because in the end, he ends up fulfilling that hero complex.
I know, which is like, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
Like, at least in Fight Club, spoilers, you should have seen it by now, at least in Fight Club, he fucking dies. You know, at least he, like, something happens. Yeah, I do think this is... how do I put this? I think he's awful, but I think you're supposed to kind of feel bad for him.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I think a lot of times, like, these loner films, specifically loner cinema, and this is a very, like, I would say this is, like, the loner cinema film that created loner cinema as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the idea where the loner doesn't really have to pay for what he did and that the loner isn't necessarily in the wrong, which
yeah.
I don't think is a great look on it, because I think sometimes it kind of like, even though that's not true, right? Like, you know, it's not true that he's in the right. If you were like him, you would be like, yeah, all right.
Yeah,
right,
exactly. Like, and they, like in this movie, it just takes you so deep into a character's personal life that it's hard not to, like, sympathize with him.
Yeah. I mean, he's a vet, right? So he's a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah. And
he was discharged, wasn't he?
Yeah, honorable discharge.
Honorable discharge. So we don't really know what happened to him in Vietnam.
No, but Vietnam was rough, and
yeah, like we all know it's a fucked up war.
You can assume that he probably has post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and so it's like he's trying to reintegrate into society almost, right? Like,
yeah.
And so basically he's a New York cabbie. He has insomnia, probably because of like problems with the war.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, okay, automatically you're like, okay, I feel bad for this guy, because we all know that, like, Vietnam vets are, like, fucked. Although, interesting that this came out when it did, because at this time we still probably would have been pretty hostile towards Vietnam vets.
Yeah, definitely. I think that probably that attitude has changed, and I would be interested to talk to someone who saw this movie in, like, the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if this movie helped, like, change that attitude, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
Although maybe not, because he doesn't turn out to be great. But
no, he's not. He's not the best guy.
Yeah, at least like for modern audiences, this like automatically you're like, aw, poor guy. And then we move into like, okay, then he sees the girl, right? He sees what's her name, Betsy. She's hot. He thinks she's like amazing.
She thinks he's hot.
He kind of stalks her. He asks her out. She's like, sure, you're kind of cute. And I think she appreciates his straightforwardness.
Yeah, yeah.
They go out on their little date. It goes kind of good, right?
Yeah, they have an interesting conversation.
Yeah, we're thinking this is good, even though in my mind, I'm like, this man's fucking crazy, Betsy. You need to get the hell out of here. But when she's like, you're a walking contradiction, I was like, I would not be okay with this. But hey, Betsy doesn't have a lot going on for her, you know? It's like mainly just her coworker that has the hots for her, and he's not much of a looker.
Yeah, and so, I would pick young Robert De Niro over that character.
Me too. I mean, I don't think Robert De Niro's the hottest, but it's the 1970s, and he does have the look.
It's true.
So then we go on, and he takes her to a porn movie.
Yeah, and it's pretty cringy. She is not and she goes comfortable.
In. Yeah, she goes in because she's like, I'll give it a try. And I wouldn't. And then she's like, yeah, I don't like this. And he cannot understand why.
Yeah, he's like, I didn't know you felt that way.
Also, I'm like, why would you try and figure that out? Because, I mean, it just kind of shows you how much he really doesn't get it. Because it's like, okay, obviously. Also, listen, I've been watching a lot of films from like the 60s and 70s recently, mm-hmm. because that's when a lot of the new waves took place. Was going to see porn at the cinema just like a huge thing? Because, like, in so many movies, couples do it. Like, so many. I've seen couples go to the cinema and just watch porn, and then that's it. And it's like,
I mean, there wasn't any internet, so where else would you go, I guess?
I mean, I don't know, but was it just like young people just, I don't know, like, I watched this film called Deep End, which is, I think actually his name, it's Jerzy Skolimowski, I think, is the director, mm-hmm. and he is a pretty influential director. In fact, I think he's still making films, maybe, but he's an English film, or actually I think he might be Polish or something, mm-hmm. but, like, in his films, like, Deep End specifically, a young couple goes to, like, see a pornographic film on, like, a date. And I always just think that, I'm like, that's weird.
I mean, guys, you know, used to watch porn together, you know, in the rumpus rooms in the 70s. And it's kind of, I guess that, like, before the internet, like, you know, group porn viewing was just a thing.
Classy porn things? Because, like, now group porn viewing's a thing, but it's, like, gross and on the side of the interstate, and you try to forget that it's there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you can still go view porn in a group, but would I take my girlfriend? I'm not sure.
To the men's spa at the XXX video store.
Ooh, yeah.
I can always tell that we're getting close to Joplin when we're coming back from Springfield because there's...
Oh, yeah, because the
adult video store with the men's spa.
I know. I really want to... I've always wanted to go into one of those, but I'm also really scared, you know?
Yeah, I'm also terrified.
I know it's truck drivers. I know who it is. I know it's people that are in semi-trucks who literally can't do it any other way. But I just, like... I always want to go, but then I'm like, that sounds like the exact place you get kidnapped and raped.
The exact place.
And then when they write the headline, they're like, but she was at a truck stop, so... Or she was at an X video store, so she was basically begging people to do it. I saw one today. I'm sure you've seen this. This girl was killed, and this guy, he killed... I cannot wait for Crime Junkies to do an episode on this. She was murdered, right? I guess she... Uh-huh. He says she died while they were having sex, but I don't know how true that is, because I think if I died accidentally, if I killed someone accidentally during sex, I would call the police. I would be pretty freaked out, and I would be like, holy shit, I accidentally killed her during sex. But instead, what he did is after she was done, he watched some porn next to her corpse, and then he put her in a suitcase, put the suitcase in his car, went out on another date with another girl with the suitcase in his car, and then tried to dump the suitcase. So, I feel like that goes beyond an accidental sex killing.
Yeah, I think that after that, I think that at the point where you're watching porn next to the corpse, I think that that is where you kind of need to pump the brakes.
I think the very first thing you did afterwards made you look extremely guilty. because the very first thing you should have done afterwards is call the fucking cops.
And the last thing you should have done is what you did.
Jerk off next to her corpse. I would say of all on the list of things that should have been done, that's at the bottom, because I would not be like, oh shit, I have blue balls, because she fucking died.
Oh my god.
At least he didn't continue to fuck her corpse, I guess, but then, so I was like reading about this, I was like, how fucked up, but you know the reason I found this? Because the New Yorker posted an article online that was like, murder victim was really into choking and BDSM, allegedly. And I was like,
what does that matter?
What does it matter? I was like, so we're trying to say that because she was into choking, that it's her fault that she got choked to death?
Oh my god. I think the New Yorker,
so His story. I know the New Yorker. I was like, okay, come on, New Yorker, really? It's 2019, people. It's 2019.
You're still trying to make a woman being murdered the woman's fault.
It's fault. I know. And I was like, okay. Okay, so basically the defense, right? This guy's defense is trying to present that, like, what was happening is they were having sex consensually. He was consensually choking her, and that they were intoxicated, and he strangled her to death. On accident, is what they're trying to say. But then, the prosecution's like, well, then he jerked up next to her corpse, so what do you do? I don't believe it was an accident. And even if it was an accident, you still tried to cover it up by putting her body in a suitcase, and then going on a date with it in the car.
Oh my gosh, this guy is not very smart.
I know, I was like, oh my god, I watched this episode of, we're really getting off track, but who cares? what is this podcast? I watched this episode of Forensic Files the other day, where this guy got caught because basically he murdered this person. He murdered this woman, stole her credit cards. It was probably like a robbery, but he stole her credit cards. And then when he went to the store and tried to use it, the cashier like needed the CID. And he said, oh, it's my girlfriend's credit card. And he was like, oh, okay. But then the guy signed his own name on the credit card receipt instead of his girlfriend's. And that's how they found him.
Oh my gosh.
Because he signed his real name onto the credit card receipt of the dead woman's credit card that he stole after he murdered her.
That's a way to go down.
I know. And then, so they use that to get the warrant into his house, right? Because they know that he has her stolen credit cards. They go in, and he's cleaned up, like, he's, like, ripped up the carpeting and burned it and stuff like that. Because he bludgeoned her to death, and he's like, clean the murder weapon, but the shoes he was wearing, he didn't clean at all, and then he wore them, the shoes, to the station when he was being interviewed by police while they were searching his home.
Oh my
god. And they noticed that there was blood splatter on the shoes, and they were like, we need to test that. And so they took it, and the blood matched. I was like, how fucking stupid. And he, to this day, is like, I swear to God I'm innocent. And I'm like, you wore the shoes with her blood on them to the police station.
It's, I need to look this up.
It's like the third episode of Forensic Files ever.
Okay. Thank you.
Like, it's like so good. I was dying. I was like, well, I guess there's really no, if the police didn't catch him, that would really be incompetency. Oh man. But anyway, yeah, like I feel like What were we, porn theaters?
Yeah, we were talking about public porn viewing, and somehow we got into necrophilia, and then we got over to Forensic Files.
It's a real ride here.
Live podcasting. So
he takes her to the porn theater. It doesn't go well.
She doesn't like it. Travis is like, I don't understand, and he like keeps trying to call her.
Everybody's doing this these days. Yeah, she won't answer. He sends her flowers, and she sends them back. And then he shows up to her work.
Yeah, where she works at a governor's office that's running for president, and he's trying to get the nomination.
He meets the governor in his taxi one night.
Yes.
And he's a fake supporter, you know, because he wants to be with this woman. And they have a very unnerving exchange in the cab.
Yeah, it's a lot. Travis is not okay at this point.
Yeah, he's a wild man. And basically, like, they meet, and he asks him, like, oh, what do you want to see change, Travis? Like, what's your issue? And Travis basically just says, like, New York is disgusting and scummy, and I want to just burn it down and rebuild it. And he's like, well, I see what you mean, Travis. And then he uses, like, he's very politician-y and gives him the line about, like, we're going to have to make some real radical changes, like, all that stuff. You know how politicians talk.
Politicians.
They don't really say stuff, but... They don't say stuff, but they say stuff. That's, like, basically the exchange. And he gets in trouble because he goes into the office and, like, yells at her.
Yeah, he yells at her, and so they don't see each other anymore. And he begins to see... One night, this girl, played by Jodie Foster, gets into his cab and is, like, trying to run away from this guy. And she's like, drive away, and he doesn't. And then the man takes her away and throws in a $20 bill for Travis, saying, like, just forget about this. And he becomes kind of fixated on this girl. She's obviously really young.
Yeah.
And then one day he sees her walking 12. Around. She's 12 and a half years old.
Baby girl. Yeah. Yeah, she's 12 and a half. And basically she's a prostitute, right?
Yeah, she's a child prostitute.
Yeah, so he basically, like, starts kind of, like, stalking her as well, like, trying to find her again so that he can help her because he realizes, like, what happened.
Yeah, he realizes she was trying to run away from her pimp, and her pimp, like, got her back.
Yeah, and so finally he, like, actually, he knows the area enough that he decides to, like, he starts buying all these guns. There's this, like, big sequence of the movie where he starts kind of going, like, really crazy. And he starts working out a lot, and he buys guns, and he burns his hand, and he says, like, oh, I'm gonna be healthy.
Very unstable things.
Very unstable things. Starts pretending to shoot a lot of people out windows. Kind of like the trademark, we're not good.
Very much like not okay at the moment, talking to himself, hearing voices.
Yeah, and he also has this, like, journal that he keeps throughout the movie, which is, like, very unstable. It's just a very, like, it's a journal that makes you go, I don't like that.
Yeah, like, honey, you're not doing too hot.
It's very, like, childlike almost, honestly.
Yeah, he's just, like, he's so rage-filled. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, he begins to, like, stalk this girl. He ends up finding her and, like, figuring out where she works, and he gets in. He meets her, like, pimp. What's his name? Scooter?
Sport.
Scooter. And then he gets... Alright. And then he gets in, and he basically sees her, and she tries to, like, come on to him, obviously, because that's her job.
And he pauses a long time every time.
So creepy. He almost considers it, and then he's like, yeah. "Wait, no, no."
Yeah, there's one scene where she starts taking off her shirt, and like he obviously sees her taking off her shirt, but then he waits until it's like off, until he's like, "Wait, stop."
I don't know.
Jodie Foster's really good though.
Yeah, Jodie Foster's amazing, and it's crazy like how young she is. You're like, "Whoa, that's Jodie Foster."
Yeah.
But then basically like he's like, "I'll take you away," and she's like, "I don't want to leave. Like, I was high. I didn't even know what I was doing." And she basically says like, "I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave. I like being here. Like, they don't treat me badly. I don't mind the work. Like, just leave me alone." And then he's like, "Well, can I at least like see you again?" And she's like, "Well, yeah, I mean, I live here." And he's like, "No, no, not like this." And so he takes her out for breakfast the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And they
become friends, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, again, he's like, "Just leave, go home." And she's like, "No, I don't want to leave. Like, I like my work." Like, she literally never once is like, "I don't like working here."
Yeah.
But then he does kind of make her think like, these guys are, you know, like, they're just using you, like,
yeah, and just
they don't
like
really care about you.
Yeah, and
I mean, truth.
Yeah, but it's true, and she, you know, a 12-and-a-half-year-old can't give their consent to do that kind of work.
Exactly. And that's what, so. And basically what he says is like, he says, like, "I'm not gonna call the cops on you, but just think about, like, this kind of work, like, you're going to be used up in a few years and nobody's going to want to care for you anymore and you're just a kid." Like, and so she kind of starts to think about that, and she goes back and kind of confronts Sport.
And then there's this really horrible scene where he's like talking to her and calling her a woman, and it's like disgusting and a lot.
And they like clearly have a romantic relationship, right? Like, he kind of like makes her feel like he loves her and that they just have to do this to be together. And then, okay, so also at this other time, our main character is planning to assassinate the senator who's running for president.
Because the basically girl who worked for the president denied him.
Yeah, basically just to get back at Betsy.
Yeah.
So, he's, like, he's getting all these guns, he's, like, rigging up all this equipment, he's, like, practicing at the shooting range every day, like, doing all these things just to, like, get ready, and he ends up going to a rally to kind of, like, scope out what it's like, I guess, and he meets a Secret Service agent there, and they have a very odd interaction.
Very much an interaction between a cop and an assassin.
Yeah, which is very odd, because I think what's so weird about it is, like, nobody ever would have caught him if he didn't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But he just, like, can't leave it alone. I think because he has, like, a hero complex, like, or, like, a goddess whore complex or something, like, where he, like, sees the only thing between, like, him and Betsy is, like, this guy. Even though it's, like, that's not true. Like, Betsy doesn't like you.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
This, like, senator didn't do anything to make that happen. It's, like, it's, like, he thinks, like, oh, this will either hurt her or, like, she'll love. I don't know. It's very strange. He like, tries. And we see this a lot. He just tries to take out. He has this, like, fixation on both Jodie Foster and Betsy, right?
Yeah.
He's got these, like, fixations on both of them. Iris, I guess, is Jodie Foster's character's name. And he also has fixations on the men in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he feels like the only thing between him and those girls, or, like, from saving those girls, is, like, the men.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. He wants to get rid of Sport, and he wants to get rid of the governor.
Yeah. Which I just think is so like, he sees himself almost like, what I think is interesting, and I think Martin Scorsese even said this, it's very, like, Western. So I think a lot of this movie was inspired by The Searchers, which is a Western film, where it's also, like, this very, like, loner character who's, like, the hero, save the girl. And I feel like Travis sees himself as that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. This lone ranger that's trying to save people. When it's, like, in reality, you're not saving anyone. Like, even Jodie Foster's character, of course, it's bad that she's in this position.
Mm-hmm.
But he could save her by calling the cops.
But he has to save save her himself.
But he has to save her. And in the end, it's like, he traumatizes her. Because there's a way that you can get her home without doing all this. And so, so basically he goes to the rally, Secret Service are, like, pretty much on to him. He leaves. And then he comes back later. I'm not sure. I don't think I'm telling this in exact chronological order, but it makes sense.
First he leaves Iris money, and then he goes out and tries to, and, like,
that's right.
has the weird conversation, like, with the die. Secret Service agent.
Yeah. And then I think he goes back and, like, burns some shit and, like, writes some letters. He, like, writes a letter to his mom and dad, writes a letter to Iris saying, like, that I'm going to be dead by the time you get this, all this stuff. And then he tries to go assassinate the governor. Doesn't work out. So then he goes back to the, like, pimp's house.
Yeah.
Where, also, he shaves his hair into a mohawk.
Very also, unstable stuff.
Yeah, I also think there's a lot of, like, Western imagery. Like, they call him, like, the cowboy. He wears cowboy boots. Yeah, and shooter. He wears cowboy boots. Like, he shaves his head into a mohawk. Like,
and he chose to take pistols. Like, he doesn't have, like, only has pistols.
Pistols, yeah. And so then he goes, he shoots Sport, moves inside the house, just starts, like, basically shooting everyone, right?
Yeah.
He encounters, like, what, 4 or 5 people, shoots them all, they all die. He gets shot in the process in, I think, the shoulder and in the neck.
Yes, shoulder and neck.
But the important one is the neck. He's not doing well, right? He got shot in the neck. So he comes in, he shoots, I think she might have been with a client or something.
Yeah, she was with a John.
Yeah, like, shoots him, and Jodie Foster's just freaking the hell out, like, as you would be. And then he basically, like, sits down on the couch, and when he wakes up, it's, like, later, future.
He was in a coma.
He was in a coma, probably from the fact that he got shot in the neck.
He's known as a hero for rescuing Iris.
Yeah, so everyone's like, wow, the vigilante that went and took down a prostitute ring, right? And saved a child prostitute when, like, in reality, he just did that because he couldn't kill the senator immediately and he had a lot of misplaced rage. But I think what's interesting is, like, even though he saves Iris, it just doesn't really feel like he saved Iris. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he could have saved Iris in such a more effective way. But due to his hero complex, he can't. He traumatizes
this, like, little girl.
More than she already has been. Murders people
right in front of her. Yeah, and also, like, again, like, Iris doesn't want to be saved. You know what I mean? Like, not that she shouldn't be saved, but it's like, yeah, she doesn't even want to be saved. And he, like, does it in such a way that's, like, this shootout, cowboy, Western, saving the damsel in distress who's, like, begging for you to save her, when it's, like, any normal person would just call the cops.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know. It's, like, it doesn't feel like a victory, even though it is.
Yeah, it feels like, it feels kind of selfish.
I mean, it is selfish, and it's, like, it is selfish. It's, like, You're not saving her because you care about her. You're saving her because you want to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's like the thing. Yeah. It's like he doesn't care about her. He wants to be a hero. Because if he really cared about her, he never would have paused. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's like... The things Travis does... He's just a very scummy person. Which
He talks constantly about the scum on the streets, too. And about how he believes everyone is beneath him.
And then it's interesting because you're like, you're the scum. Like, when you really look at it, you don't really meet anyone who you don't like. Like, even... I mean, Sport's probably, like, the next scummiest person we meet.
Yeah.
Like, he's scum. But everyone else we meet is perfectly nice.
Yeah, like, definitely.
It's like he is the scummy one, which I think is really interesting. It's just, like, his ego.
He's a narcissist, so you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one of those... If he went to therapy... If a guy had gone to therapy, a movie that never would have happened. But also then at the end, the very end, after he's a hero, he's working his taxi, and who should get in but Betsy?
And there's like this really pretty shot of her in his rear view mirror where you can pretty much just see her eyes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very pretty shot. That whole scene is really, really pretty in the way it's shot. And they have, an exchange. And basically...
Kind of where you can tell Betsy's like, I'm cool with you again.
Yeah.
And then he drives away, and something happens where he gets really manic and checks the rearview mirror a lot and looks really panicked. And upset.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie ends. Ooh. Also, that score. Ooh, that trumpet.
Every
time it plays, I'm like, ooh. There's a lot of, theories about the ending.
Okay. Can you unpack some for me?
Yeah. I'm going to talk about the two main ones because all the other ones are kind of dumb. These two are the only ones, I think, with, any real credit.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think that the ending is real, that that's exactly what happens. Betsy gets in the cab. He actually is a hero unintentionally. But there's a lot of people that also think that it's actually a dream sequence and that either he died or he's in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's kind of seeing what he wants to see.
Okay.
A lot of people think this because... for one, they just don't think the ending's very realistic, that he becomes, the hero, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of people say the manicness at the end is him, kind of recognizing that actually he's not the hero and panicking because he realizes that he's dying.
Yeah.
And that's why he's freaking out. And a lot of people think, some people think that, or some people think it's like a hallucination as he bleeds out and that we're still on the couch. So, but then a lot of people also think it's just actually how it is. And his panic at the end is supposed to show us that he isn't better. He's still just a ticking time bomb. And to me, it kind of seems like we're back to the fixation on Betsy, in my opinion. That's what the look is.
Yeah. Yeah, he's starting to have those racing thoughts and obsessive thoughts again.
Again, that's what I think it is. I'm not sure it's to show us necessarily that he's a ticking time bomb. I think it's specifically targeted towards Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
This, crazed obsession with her is, coming back.
And just to show us really, that he's not better.
Exactly, because he's not better. He's not the hero, right?
Yeah.
Because we know that he's not the hero. But, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think he's alive or do you think he's dead?
I think he's alive. I like the theory that he is, that the look of panic on his face is look of panic and being manic is him being kind of fixated on Betsy. But also I do really like the idea of him realizing that he's not the hero.
Yeah. I there are a couple reasons why I think that he is alive, and they have more to do with Martin Scorsese and the loner genre than they do with actually, like,
okay,
the movie necessarily. So Martin Scorsese, this isn't the first, like, loner genre film he's ever made, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Martin Scorsese is actually really fond of rewarding the loners in his loner genre films. They usually come out on top, or they usually get what they want. Like, there are a lot of loner genre movies where loners die, but those are actually a lot of earlier films. And I think, like, look at Joker, for example. Like, the Joker isn't punished.
No, not at all.
You know what I mean? Like, the Joker is maybe a little bit more than Travis, but he's, like, celebrated. He's, like, rewarded for his, like, efforts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of it has to do more with, like, I think the manicness at the end is more to do with showing us, like, that he's not better and that this is, like, a short-lived reward. Or that he's tricked people for the time being or something.
Yeah.
Just because I think, like, I don't think he would have written him as dead. Or I think that would have been maybe made more clear.
Do you think that maybe that look of panic and, do you think that that could be him really realizing that he's not really the hero? Or do you think that that could only happen if he were dying?
I think it would only happen if he were dying. And mainly, here's why. Because it's not front, face forward, it's in the rearview mirror.
Gotcha. Okay.
Like, if we were facing forward and he was panicking, I would feel more like he understood his wrongdoings. But the fact that he's looking back at where he came from, to me, puts more focus on her.
Okay.
And, oh, another reason a lot of people think it's actually a dream sequence is because she's only ever shown in the rear view and we don't actually see her.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that it could be like he's imagining it, and then maybe that look of panic is him figuring out that none of this is real. And looking back in there because he imagined the whole thing. But I also don't think that's necessarily the most fair to say, because while in modern day that shot is not used a lot, back in the day that just would have been a very pretty shot that would have been used quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like, Alfred Hitchcock uses that shot. The rear view mirror in a car with the lights on the eyes is a huge 60s, 70s movie thing because it's pretty. And it makes it feel very cool. And I think it's just an appropriate shot. I don't necessarily think that the shot means anything.
Yeah.
Especially because we haven't, in this movie, the cinematography is beautiful, obviously, but the shots they're not really used that way, if that makes sense. They're not really used, like, symbolically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Spike Lee uses cameras very symbolically in his films. Martin Scorsese, not so much. More on, like, the acting and the writing.
Yeah.
Like, versus... And also, like, in the script writing, all of the panic and stuff at the end isn't even there. Like, that's all added by Scorsese. So, I certainly don't think the script writer's intent was that he died.
Yeah.
So I feel like, again, it's more of just, like, to show us that he's crazy. Although it's a cool theory that he dies. Certainly, it's more of a what for him.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, as you said, I think Scorsese probably, if that theme is being held throughout loner movies, that they are rewarded, I think that that's probably the case.
Yeah, and I mean, he just doesn't really have any films where his, like, loner characters are really punished very hard, so I just don't really see this being...
Are you there?
This film being, like, one of his first, I don't really see, like... I guess not his first, because, like, Raging Bull was before this, but I just don't really see it. I don't agree. I get it. I mean, the camera work, it does feel different, but also I think every scene from when he wakes up feels cleaner to me.
Yeah.
And I think that that is supposed to be clean, and then when he freaks out is when we start seeing the, like, scumminess again.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that soundtrack. Can't get over it.
It's so good. It's, the jazz and, like...
And the use of those red lights, baby.
Oh my gosh, they're so good. It's just, it's a beautiful movie.
I know.
So entrancing.
It really is. It really is. It's definitely not a movie I could watch all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's very good. It's just very good.
I love a Scorsese movie.
Yes, me too. Me too.
What would you give this movie?
I have an IMDb. Oh, it's a 10.
It's a 10. It's a 10, you guys.
It's a 10. It's a classic. It's super influential. It's just excellent. Like, every time I do watch it, I enjoy it. It's just, like, one of those films that it is kind of long. At least it feels kind of long.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, like, one that you really have to watch.
Yeah, you can't just turn it on.
It's not a film that makes you feel good. It's an emotional film, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really hard to be at a party and watch Jodie Foster take off her clothes. It's a lot.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I think that everybody has films. In fact, I saw this, it was trending on Twitter the other day. Everybody has films, like, that you love, but that you don't want to see again. You know what I mean? Like, you acknowledge that they're great films, but you don't want to watch them again. Like, I think a lot of Mother, that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people really like that film, but they don't want to see it. Because it's hard to watch. Like,
yeah.
You're glad you watched it, but it's not an easy movie to watch.
Did you know that movie is the reason that Darren Aronofsky and Jennifer Lawrence broke up?
Wow.
Because he couldn't handle that no one liked it.
I didn't even know they were dating.
Yeah, they were dating when it was being made.
I thought people loved that movie.
I think critics didn't like it.
That's stupid. Listen, what do the fucking critics know? What did Ratatouille teach us? That critics don't know shit. That's what they taught us.
That's what it taught us.
I think that had a great audience reception. It's a harsh movie. It's a harsh movie to watch.
It's harsh.
There's a lot of movies like that. This is one of those where it's like, it is emotionally draining to watch.
Yeah, for sure. Especially the Iris scenes for me are just really a lot.
Yeah. And honestly, pretty much every scene where he's just in his apartment, I'm like, this is just so difficult to watch.
Yeah. Anytime, like, he's writing in his journal, it's like, whew.
It's just, it's just watching someone lose it. Like, someone already really unstable who you already don't like just really fucking go down.
Yeah.
And you're like, ugh, it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch because, yeah, it makes you think about yourself a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
Especially because you have to, like, grapple with this idea of, like, he does a good thing, but he's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, it's almost like you don't like that he frees Iris, and that makes you feel bad.
He's a walking contradiction.
Because he's a walking contradiction. He does a good thing, but you don't feel good about it. Ooh. Because you know that he's not a good person. And it's a difficult thing to grasp. That little cognitive dissonance you have it really takes it out of you.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I have an IMDb review.
Yes, please.
Of course. Of course it thinks it's really bad. I really wanted to find one where somebody identified, like, far too much with Travis, but I couldn't.
Ugh, that sucks, but also is kind of a good thing.
I know. There was, like, one that was, like, sort of, but it kind of got out of it, and I was like, I'm not sure I also want to find a crazy person's review. I bet I could find it for Fight Club. People fucking love Fight Club.
They like it a lot. It's a lot.
Boys that don't have a grasp on their emotions sure do love Fight Club. So, why this film, 1 out of 10, why this film is a classic is a profound mystery. Martin Scorsese is just one of those directors I just do not seem to get. His films are not totally inaccessible, like most of the work of Stanley Kubrick, but sitting through a Scorsese production is often just an exercise that pendulums back and forth between crashing boredom and utter incomprehensibility.
Okay.
Yep. Of course, everyone by now knows that Taxi Driver is about isolation. Specifically, the isolation of one man in the midst of a bustling city. Travis Bickle, a Vietnam, they spell Vietnam as two words, a Vietnam veteran, applies for a job driving a taxi in New York on a graveyard shift. The reason he gives for not wanting the job, is that he does not sleep at night. That anyone would hire him to actually drive a vehicle under those conditions seems odd, but then again, everything about Bickle is odd. Clearly he suffers from profound sense of isolation, but most of that is of his own making, since when it comes to social interaction, this guy is so clueless that he makes burnout Reverend Jim from the television show Taxi seem like Albert Einstein by comparison. Weird. I want to say that that's actually a really big problem that a lot of veterans have, is like reintegration into society.
And not feeling like they belong.
Yeah, especially Vietnam veterans. Which I feel is, it's like, kind of the point is that he's so consumed by, like, all this rage and violence and, like, these feelings that he just doesn't know what to do with. And instead of, like, looking inward and realizing that, like, that's on him, he thinks it's outside forces doing it to him, even though in reality it's more like, you're messed up from the war.
Yeah.
And you need to, like, look inside. And that's a really big problem with a lot of veterans.
Yeah.
Especially Vietnam veterans. Travis finds himself attracted to Betsy, a woman working on a presidential campaign of a politician. Civil Shepherd, proving yet again she could not act her way out of a cream puff factory. I do not know what that means.
Nope.
And he has sufficient social skills to get her to agree to a movie date. Of course, she cannot. Oh, then he takes her to an XXX porn film. Of course, she can knock it out of there fast enough, and he is totally bewildered. In his mind, it was a perfect date movie. A good deal of the story is told via Travis's inner thoughts spoken by De Niro on the soundtrack. The device was old, even in 1976, and there's too much of it. The audience is already alienated from this man, and having his thoughts overdubbed places him even farther from anything remotely approaching understanding. I, again, kind of think this is the point a little bit, that you're supposed to feel sympathy for him because he has so many problems. Like, he's an alcoholic, he's a drug addict, he's a veteran, he's sad, he's depressed, like, he's a narcissist. But at the same time, it's like, he's so off-putting.
Yeah, yeah, he's just like, you don't like him. But you feel so bad for him at the same time.
You feel bad, but you can't like him. And it's why the ending is so unsettling. It's why it's so taxing, is because he does a good thing and he's, but you don't like him. Like, you don't care that he saved a prostitute. Like, and it's honestly, this is kind of like bad, but Sport is more charming than him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, I think that's part of the point. I think that's probably something that Scorsese was getting
at. Sport is disgusting. He is a literal pimp for child prostitutes. And yet, he's more likable.
God.
Like, and it makes you feel gross. It makes you feel gross that you think that, but, like, you do. Possibly the best scenes in the films are the ones with Jodie Foster as Iris, a 12-year-old prostitute whom Travis attempts to rescue from what he sees as a sordid life. Iris is possibly the most interesting person in the film. Foster plays her as a girl walking a tightrope between what she has to do to survive and the necessity to avoid danger. She is receptive to Travis at first, but even a 12-year-old can see that this guy is not playing with a full deck. And at least she breathes some life into an unbearably tedious movie. I also really disagree with that. I was like, where does it ever show that Iris doesn't trust him?
Yeah, no, I think that she obviously likes him a lot, especially at the breakfast.
And that's the last interaction she has with him before he fucking blows the place up.
Yeah.
Which brings us to De Niro. He's good here, but he's much better elsewhere. Watching him, I had the impression that Scorsese went to one of two extremes. Either he gave the actor no direction at all and let him do as he pleased, or he micromanaged every nuance of the character and in the process sucked the life out of it. Whatever the result is stilted and peculiar bit of acting that seems to get beneath a major talent like De Niro. Yes, we see Travis's isolation, but we never know what caused it or why he is so damn weird.
Vietnam?
Again. Also, again, like, if we knew Travis's entire backstory and before he went to the war, he was a completely put together person, we'd be like, this is the saddest fucking movie ever. Like, you're not supposed to like him.
No.
You're supposed to think he's weird and gross. Like, and also, I think part of, like, the acting is really stilted, and, like, especially when he's speaking, right? Like, he speaks in these weird chunks, but I think it's like, just supposed to make you be like, ew, like, why is he talking like that? Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
And of course, as is Scorsese's habit, all of this is presented under the guise of gritty reality. Thank Goodfellas and Raging Bull, both of which ram gritty reality down the viewer's throat until the urge to run screaming from the theater is almost overwhelming. I am a native of New York City. I was born there and lived there until I was 42. Martin Scorsese is also a native of the city, but I do not recognize this picture of NYC he paints in this film at all. The simple answer is that we are seeing the city through Travis Bickle's eyes, but while he describes what he sees, we never find out why he sees things the way he does. It's perhaps the most frustrating aspect of a very frustrating film. I don't think you're supposed to know why. Because he's fucked up. I don't know, because he's a fucked up guy. Why did Jeffrey Dahmer kill people and eat them? I don't know. Like, because he's messed up.
Yeah, and I think that's film. Part of the reason why they don't share his backstory with us, because we could identify with him more if they shared the backstory, and we're supposed to we're not supposed to see him as the hero, because we're supposed to know that he is not, and that's why the ending is so disturbing.
Exactly. It's like, it's if you knew, I mean, I guess, like, I think about the Joker, I was trying not to spoil anything here, but you find out why the Joker is so messed up, and it makes you feel almost so bad for him that you don't even care about what he does.
Yeah, it gets very close.
It becomes the Joker does such bad things that, and you also see in any other Batman movie, he does so many bad things that you're like, I can't forgive him, but you're close. And this guy, you're not even close to forgiving him, and he does a good thing. He does a good thing and you still don't like him. The Joker only does bad things. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and because we know so much about him, because we know so much about what he's been through and why he is the way he is, we can understand him more and therefore feel more sympathy for him.
Exactly. And this guy, you kind of feel how other people feel about him, right? Like, he's so incredibly unlikable that it doesn't matter what he does. Like, he saves a child prostitute, and I still don't like him.
Yeah, because he paused. Like, he paused.
Because he paused. And because you know that he was going to kill a guy who ever did nothing. Because, you know, like, he stalks women. Like, you know what I mean? And not only that, he's just fucking weird and gross. Like, he's a weirdo. You know what I mean? And ultimately, that's kind of sad, but that's really what it comes down to, is at the end of the day, I can't like him because he's weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. And it doesn't really matter why, because he's a weirdo, and that's all that matters. All right, great film? Depends on which critic you ask. The late Roger Ebert? Ebert. Loved it. I think it's Roger Ebert. Leonard Martin thinks it's awful. I suspect that, like most of Scorsese's this is one of those movies you either love it or you hate it. Well, I didn't exactly hate it, although you gave it a 1, but most of it is insufferably boring. De Niro presents us with a wacko character, but fails to provide a province for his behavior. I also want to say, Martin Scorsese didn't write this film. He directed it. About the only good thing I can say about Sybil Shepherd is that her role is brief, as she's absolutely painful to watch. It is only Jodie Foster, all of 12 years old, yet wearing an ancient expression in her eyes that tells the story of where this girl has been, that draws and holds the audience's attention. Honestly, without Foster in the film, it would have no life at all. And possibly the worst of it is that Bickle's increasing descent into violence is left totally unexplained. It would be easy to assume that it was his Vietnam service that unhinged him, yet again spelled as two words, but this movie does not play that way, and at any rate, if it were the case, it would have been an easy matter to communicate it. To put it in 5 short words, this film is a mess.
This guy seems to have a little bit of a fixation on Jodie Foster.
I thought that too. I was like, Jodie Foster is good, but she's not, like, Wow, Jodie Foster, amazing blowout performance. Also, she's not even in the film that much.
No, she's only in a couple scenes.
I also have to say, like, is that the reason why, or is it because she's a child prostitute and you can imagine what a child prostitute has been through? Is that the reason you think her performance is good, or is it because she has so much in-depth character? You know what I mean? I think it's more that she's a child prostitute, and that's really easy for you to understand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for him, it's not... I think the other thing, too, is it's not... He's not that messed up because of Vietnam. Vietnam may have messed him up more and made him violent, but he was clearly unhinged beforehand. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And also, what do you mean what causes him to go into this descent into violence? A girl breaks up with him.
And he can't handle it, and that happens all the time. That's a really realistic thing.
Exactly. I was like, that totally happens, and it's totally what sends him in his downward spiral. Like, he's already not doing great, but then when the woman he becomes obsessed with breaks up with him, yeah, the stalker doesn't take that well. Shocking. I'm surprised the unhinged stalker went berserk. He even got to go on one date with her. A lot of stalkers never get to go on a date at all, and they still just go fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when will Mark Ruffalo play a stalker?
When he's made for the role.
I know. He'd be amazing. I literally can't get over
We're
that.
We're at the time.
I want it so bad.
Today is the day.
It's now or never, because he's getting too old.
He's getting too old to do it, but it's a perfect time for him to play a stalker, and he would nail it. Oh my gosh.
He's got all the money. He's got all the money from the Avengers films. He can really fucking stop doing that, and he can move on to do some good films. More actors need to be like Jake Gyllenhaal, you know? Where they do, like, one big movie every once in a while for their money.
Yeah.
But then they just do good films.
They just do artsy.
If I was a famous actor, that's all I'd do. I would do, like, a big film every once in a while for, like, lots and lots of money. Or maybe a film franchise for lots and lots of money. And then I'd just do art films. Especially because, can you imagine the kind of films you could just skyrocket to, like, fame because you were big?
Yeah.
And they would never have the budget to get that big otherwise.
That's...
I want to be in an Ari Aster film. Ari Aster, cast me in one of your films, please.
I think that you would get cast if you auditioned.
That's very sweet of you to say.
I
don't know if that's
as some role.
Sure. Background character number 57. Girl that walks past screen for a moment.
Yes.
There we go. I appreciate that. I do think Ari Aster at least cast people that look realistically like people.
Yeah.
So at least I have that. At least I wouldn't have to worry about like the fact that I'm not a model.
Yeah,
I'm never going to be in an Avengers film, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's okay.
Or I guess no one will be. But, you know.
Yeah.
Ari Aster, he's going to move to comedy, so I don't know, maybe.
We'll see.
If I take an Ari Aster comedy film, I'm going to be pigeonholed in comedy for the rest of my life. I'll never get out. Okay.
Okay.
I think that's it.
I think that's it. Thank you guys so much for listening. Follow us on social media.
Heck yeah. Social media. Patreon. Give us a review on iTunes. You know.
You know.
You know. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.